It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Veronica Ricker today.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Today is Martin Luther King Jr. Day, also known as the Day of Service. While it's a federal holiday, organizers have urged people to make it a day on, not a day off.
So we want to know, what are you doing today to commemorate the MLK Day of Service? Do you volunteer regularly? What do you do to help others in your community, and why do you do it? Call us at 1-800-642-1234 or send us an email to talk@wpr.org.
Here to talk about the Day of Service and some of the benefits of volunteering is Matthew Van Ness. He's the director of Volunteer Wisconsin. Matt, welcome to Central Time.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
What is the MLK Day of Service? How did it get started?
Well, it originally started through a couple of efforts by a couple of senators, and it was signed into law by President Clinton in 1994. It's to commemorate Dr. King's just his whole envisioning of serving the communities that we live in. And it was passed into law in 1994. And as you mentioned, it's a day on, not a day off.
And so what kind of opportunities were available today for people to take part in the Day of Service?
Well, there were many types of opportunities, including people were volunteering at their local thrift shops to help sort clothing, volunteering at food banks. Some other ones that I saw interesting were the Red Cross has sponsored an event where they were hanging tags on doors for safety tips in case of fire, things like that, just getting people out into their communities and making a difference.
Well, a lot of the focus on volunteering is the benefits of the work that gets done, and I think we can talk about that a little. But what are some of the benefits to the volunteer? What do we get out of it, I guess?
Well, it's what you want to get out of it, but many volunteers can gain different skills. Many use volunteering as an opportunity to advance their careers. Some simply volunteer just to feel better about themselves. And there are other people who are very passionate about a cause or an agency. And by volunteering with them, they can feel more a part of it. They can explore skills or explore hobbies and things like that that they want to share with other people. If you have a love of outdoors, you can organize a hike for school students, that type of thing.
A lot of people, as they get close to retirement, talk about having more time to be able to volunteer and that that's something they're looking forward to. Are there particular benefits that older volunteers get from the experience?
Well, there's plenty of studies out there that show that volunteering is a very healthy endeavor. It makes people feel more connected. They're out in the community. They feel their happiness level is higher than those who don't volunteer. So, and as we all know, if you're happier, you feel healthier, you feel more connected.
We're talking to Matt Van Ness about volunteering on this Day of Service. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you volunteer? Where do you volunteer? And what does it do for you? What do you get out of it? How do you feel after putting in that shift or making that thing or whatever it is you do? Call 800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. Matt, you sent us some information about the connection between volunteering and improved health. Why do you think there's that connection?
Well, it's that feeling that you're part of the community. You're not shut into your own house or apartment. You're getting out. You're getting exercise. You're sharing your skills with someone who may not have them. So, again, if you're very passionate about a hobby or something like that, you're able to share that. And that will always benefit your health because you are part of the community.
And to get those benefits, do you have to be volunteering on a regular basis, you know, a regular set shift maybe at a food pantry or at a homeless shelter? Or can you get those benefits from doing different things at different times?
Well, I think you can. Not everybody can commit to a schedule for volunteering, But those individuals who pick out those days where they can, or if they plan out that, you know, 2 months from now I'm going to have a couple of days off and I want to volunteer, you know, that's healthy for them, where they can plan those days, they can look at the opportunities available. No, it's not necessary to volunteer on a regular basis. We encourage it. But, you know, if you only have time to do, well, today is a prime example. If you're only available on today, communities would relish the fact that you're out in their area helping the community.
I know that in some communities, the United Way does a Day of Caring, and that's an opportunity to go with a work group or friends and do that one day of service like you were talking about.
Yes. Yes, and there are many companies and many organizations who plan around Martin Luther King Day. They look at this as an opportunity to show their commitment to the communities where their companies reside. It's also an opportunity to expose their employees to other volunteer opportunities that they might not even have thought of.
We'll take our first caller now at 800-642-1234. We've got Shirley on the line in Eau Claire. Shirley, hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. Where do you volunteer?
I volunteer at Sacred Heart Hospital.
What do you do there?
I do Meals on Wheels for seniors.
And first of all, thank you for your volunteering. What do you like about doing it?
12 years.
12 years. What do you like about doing it?
I enjoy people, enjoy socializing, and, you know, it's a good job, and I wish more people can do it.
All right. Thank you so much, Shirley, for volunteering and for calling in to tell us about it. Socializing, she mentioned, a good opportunity to socialize and maybe for some people to build social skills, Matt.
Yes, it's a wonderful opportunity. And, you know, what she's offering, first I would like to thank Shirley for her service. That is just great. But she mentioned socializing. Sometimes folks, Meals on Wheels is a prime example. That may be the only opportunity that person at home has a chance to speak with somebody on a regular basis. So as far as socializing, you know, you're building your communication skills. And as I mentioned earlier, that might advance your career. But they're offering an outlet for those people that may not be able to get out to talk to somebody and just feel better about themselves.
You talked about it as a way to advance your career just by building those kind of soft skills, those social skills. But I'm imagining that there are some direct ways that you could also advance your career through a volunteer commitment.
Oh, sure. Many, you know, in this day and age when many people are out of work or things like that and they're looking for something to do, volunteering is a great thing to put on your resume. But it also helps build, let's say you volunteer in an office, you can hone your office skills. Many agencies or places where you volunteer will help you get up and running on their computer system, show you how to use the different programs. So if that is something you would like to learn, volunteering is a great way to do that.
I think it's also a great way to have additional people to use as references as well.
Oh, definitely. The volunteer managers, if they would be more than happy to recommend a person who volunteers, because they know that that person is giving, is committed.
We'll go back to our callers now. We've got Kathy on the line in Springbrook. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. I appreciate you taking my phone call. I heard volunteering. I'm coming home from work, and actually I'm a farmer, but I heard your discussion here, and I wanted to call in and let people know. I used to take two of my dogs to the nursing home up in Hayward, Wisconsin. We would go once a month, and the dogs did have to go through some training, but it was just awesome to see how the dogs brought out a sparkle in the nursing home, in the people at the nursing home, how it brought a sparkle out in their eyes, and some of them would start talking about how they used to have a dog and what they used to do, you know, with their dog, and it was their best companion. And then some people who whose mobility was so poor, you could see their hands starting to edge down, you know, off the bed or the wheelchair to pet the dog. So that was great to see, you know, to have them do some interaction with a dog where sometimes, you know, they would just sit in the wheelchair or sit in the bed and do nothing. So for me, it was the gratitude of just seeing that and having my dogs go there and, you know, make such a great connection with the elderly people who don't get anyone. Some people don't get anyone there to visit them, and that's sad that we don't take care of our elderly people.
Thank you so much, Kathy. Thanks to you and your dogs for doing that.
And going along with the animal connection there, Anna emails, I volunteer at the local cat shelter. I'm responsible one day a week for taking care of the daily chores, but I actually go there every day of the week to socialize with the cats. It makes the cats more adoptable, and it makes me feel good to know I'm helping with that process. I absolutely love cats, and I look forward to their companionship and funny antics every day. Well, thanks for that email.
Matt, that makes me think in both these cases, Kathy has her dog. She loves her dog. She lives with them. Anna loves cats. Finding a volunteer opportunity that really, like you mentioned, just captures your own interests and running with it.
Yes. Really, when you volunteer, you should explore some questions about what you like to do, what would interest you. If you don't like what you're volunteering for, it's not going to be an enjoyable experience for you. So you should really, you know, do a little soul searching, so to speak, and think about what you would like to do, what you would like to contribute to the community, but also what you'd like to learn, not only about your own skills or about what you may want to possibly explore in the future.
We're talking to Matthew Van Ness. He's director of Volunteer Wisconsin. We're talking about the benefits of volunteering.
And we want to hear from you. What are you doing to commemorate the MLK Day of Service? Are you a volunteer? What do you do to help others in your community? And why do you do it? You can call 1-800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org to share your stories. We're continuing our conversation with Matthew Van Ness about the benefits of volunteering.
And we want to hear from you. Where do you volunteer? Why do you volunteer? Call us at 800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. Back to your questions, to your calls in just a minute. But Matt, before we do that, if someone's thinking, gosh, I've been meaning to volunteer and do something for a long time, but I don't know where to start, where do they start?
Well, there's many places to start. Number one, I would recommend if there's a volunteer center in your community, I would contact them. Otherwise, Volunteer Wisconsin is at volunteerwisconsin.org. There are opportunities listed. There are other websites people can go to, such as servewisconsin.org or even just serve.gov. That lists many opportunities. People can search by their state, local region. They can find opportunities very close to them. Another way is to look at bulletin boards. Check out your library bulletin boards, your church bulletin boards, community calendars that are posted on TV, radio. Explore what's available at the local schools. They might have tutoring available. Other things that people can do is that they can post their skills, or they can fill out a volunteer application at their volunteer center or on volunteerwisconsin.org and post their skills, and agencies looking for them can find those volunteers.
Let's go back to the phones, and Cindy and Boyd is up next. Hi, Cindy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What kind of volunteering do you do?
I help on the Stanley Rodeo. We're on the committee, and it's all a nonprofit, so we just kind of help organize and get the Stanley Rodeo going.
And what do you do that is satisfying to you about that volunteer experience?
Well, I'm fairly new to the community, so it was great to get me out to meet the community and feel like part of the community.
Great. Thanks so much for that call, Cindy.
So that's a great way to think about it, Matt. You've just moved to a new place. You need to meet some people. Why not volunteer at the local rodeo?
Well, that's just a wonderful example of that. She's new to the area. She gets involved in the community. It's an opportunity to make connections in the community, to make some new friends, find people of similar interest.
Thanks a lot for the call, Cindy. We'll go to Susan in Wausau now. Susan, hi.
Good evening. I'm just sharing a couple of experiences. Number one, I'm going tonight, in fact. I volunteer at my church, and they have a Bible study for mentally challenged adults. And the very first time I came there, there was another woman who had come also, and it became so apparent to me that this, for her, this just was not a good fit. For me, I worked with children in a neurodevelopmental clinic as a nurse. It just fit. I love it. I get more out of it than I give. And it just brings me joy to be with these people. And that's my personal experience. I had a friend who years ago lost a baby near birth, and she or her husband led a grief counseling group for a couple of years after the baby died. And she eventually became very, she was hired by Aspirus Hospice, and she worked with the hospice program for years. And I really think that her experience with her own child was a beginning. And
Thanks for that call, Susan. And Matt, that really brings up a good point that, you know, we need to choose wisely, I think, what kind of volunteer experience is good for us and that we'll be well suited to. What kind of question should a potential volunteer ask themselves?
Well, do you want to work with people or would you rather work alone? Do you like to work behind the scenes of an organization or do you want to be up front? You know, what kind of skills can you bring to that agency? And that brings up a point. You know, many professionals, they have a skill that, you know, maybe they don't think that's, you know, applicable out to the volunteer community. But, you know, somebody who is, say, a computer programmer or designer might be able to help out with those little IT problems that nonprofits have. You know, they don't have the budget, so volunteering for those types of things. You could, you know, for example, you know, are you, the questions you might want to ask, you know, do you want to have a lot of responsibility? You need to ask, you know, what kind of time commitments are involved. Is it a one-day event or is it, do they need me for 2 or 3 days? Can I commit to that? So it really is taking a look at yourself and what you would like to give and also what you would like to receive out of it.
Stacy in Stoddard is up next. Hi, Stacy.
Yes. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I've listened for a long time. I'm excited to be on, and this topic is very important to myself and my family.
And what do you do as volunteers?
Yeah, as volunteers, we really do it as a family. We have for many years. I have 2 sons who are 12 and 15, and we've just decided early on that that was an important way for us to be involved in the community. We're all kind of one together, and if there are needs and we can help, we want to be there. So the things we do, primarily we help out at our local food pantry called Wafer. We do that on a regular basis, and we help out at the Salvation Army, various things they have going on throughout the year, and it's been rewarding for all of us, and hopefully we've been able to help just a little bit within our community.
Thanks for that call, Stacy. And Matt, that's a great way to do it because sometimes it feels like, well, if I take on a volunteer opportunity, it's going to be time away from the family. But Stacy is actually combining the two.
Oh, I think that's great. And I'd like to thank Stacy for that because she mentioned what they give to the community. But I also feel that Stacy's family gets a lot of joy and they're actually building the bonds within their family, too.
We have a tweet from Teresa. She writes, I volunteer with the Girl Scouts and will hopefully be volunteering to coach soccer this spring. That makes me think maybe there are ways to volunteer and get exercise at the same time, Matt.
Well, that's great. You know, that's the thing you asked about being healthy. People that help coach, they're working with those kids out there. They're outside getting fresh air, you know, showing technique and all that type of thing. So they're, you know, staying physical as they teach children a new skill.
And Matt, why don't you give people kind of a pep talk about why people who may never have been able to do volunteering in the past, why this should be the year that they give it a try?
Well, I'd like to challenge people. It's a way to get out of the same thing that you're doing every day. You get to explore different cultures. You get to explore different experiences. People that are much older than you have so much to share just by sitting with somebody in a retirement community and listen and just talk, maybe play a game. You're going to learn so much from them, but also working with the younger generations or volunteering with students or children, helping them to read, you know, you're going to help them as they progress through life too. And they might look to you as an example and say, wow, I remember that volunteer who came into my fourth grade class and helped me read. I want to do that. So they might give back in that way.
Matt, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Oh, I appreciate being on.
That was Matthew Van Ass, Director of Volunteer at Wisconsin. You know, about 18, 19 years ago, I volunteered at a radio station. No idea what I was doing. No intention to make a career of it or anything.
What
you
a
too,
coincidence.
Right?
Yeah. I was at the same radio station.
Yep. So here we are.
It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, filling in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farad. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll learn what the difference is between the Sunni and Shia sects of Islam. We often hear about this divide in the news, and our guests will give us the history and discuss how it affects relations in the Middle East today.
But first, we're talking about the Detroit Auto Show, which opened to the public this weekend. What new models were unveiled, and what's new in the auto industry?
Paul Eisenstein is with us to share what he saw at this year's show. He's publisher and editor of the DetroitBureau.com. Paul, welcome back to the show.
Hey, good to be back with you.
So first, give us a sense of what we get at an auto show. Is this stuff that's going to be, you know, at the dealers next week, or are these the cars of the future?
Well, certainly the cars that are in the majority at the show are the cars you can get today. You'll see all the 2014 models all over the floor at Cobo Hall. But what really draws people to the car show, and certainly draws, oh, it was over 5,000 of us journalists this year, are the cars that will be there tomorrow or next year and sometimes years afterwards. So there were about 50 new product previews. Some of them will be hitting the showrooms in as few as 3 or 4 weeks, others next year. Some of them may not be out for a couple of years.
What are some of the big trends you've seen at the show this year?
Well, there's quite a few interesting things at this show. Anybody who is into the auto industry probably knows that what we've seen at car shows all over the world, never mind just Detroit or even in the United States in recent years, has been a focus on green technology. The number of new battery cars, whether they're hybrids, plug-ins, or pure electric vehicles, has been huge. That seems to be the subject of almost every car show. We even saw 3 hydrogen cars show up in the L.A. Auto Show just a few months back. What's really curious is this year, the focus was on performance, if you will, muscle cars. Now, Detroit was one of the biggest here. We had the North American International Auto Show begin with a jury of 48 North American journalists, I'm one, award the Car of the Year to the Corvette Stingray, which debuted a year ago at the show. The Corvette Z06 was here. This is the new 625 horsepower version of the Corvette. But what was really interesting was that even Toyota showed up this year with a performance car, a performance car under their Lexus brand, and another concept vehicle called the FT1 sports car that they previewed for the Toyota brand itself.
So if that green technology isn't front and center, are automakers ignoring the eco-friendly green trend completely in Detroit?
Oh, no, not at all. And again, remember, this is automakers from all over the world that are showing performance vehicles. It's not like Detroit took over here and, Chevrolet and Ford and Chrysler were bucking the trend. No, it's makers from all over the world, and that reflects the reality of what the market's demanding. We can talk about green all we want, but the fact is electric vehicles and regular hybrids aren't making up very much of the market. They accounted for a very small percentage of the overall U.S. car market last year. Performance cars outsold them by a fair bit. The difference is that the performance cars that we're seeing right now are in many ways green, or at least greener than they used to be. Imagine, if you will, a decade ago being told by somebody that a Corvette Stingray would be able to get 30 miles a gallon. But that's what the base version of the Corvette at only 450 horsepower can get on the highway right now, 30 miles a gallon. And you are seeing this sort of thing happening from all sorts of performance cars. Many of them are getting the sort of mileage that a decade ago you would have been happy to get out of a subcompact.
How are they doing that? How are automakers getting that kind of performance that you'd expect from a performance car, but boosting mileage at the same time?
Well, there's a lot of different ways, and it really depends on what approach each individual maker is taking. The Corvette has the classic big block V8, and the way that they're doing it is by using all sorts of smart new approaches. The car is lighter, the car is more aerodynamic. It uses a multi-speed gearbox. It has direct injection, and it has something called displacement on demand, a fancy way of saying that half of its eight cylinders can shut off when it's cruising down the highway, and you don't need that much power to keep it going at a steady speed. You have Porsche that has been using something called stop-start, a technology that many people believe will be in the majority of vehicles in the United States in not that many years. Maybe some of your listeners have already experienced this. You come to a stoplight, or maybe you're at a bank line or fast food line. You put your foot on the brake, and the engine automatically shuts off. Lift your foot off the brake, and suddenly it automatically restarts. And the idea is you can save anywhere from, you know, depend on whose numbers you trust, anywhere from 3% to 7% of your mileage, especially if you're somebody who spends a lot of time in town and doing a lot of stop-and-go driving.
You mentioned making vehicles lighter, and at the opposite end from those Porsches and things like that, the Ford F-150 is something I've been seeing headlines about, changing to aluminum to get lighter.
Yeah, it doesn't matter what segment of the market you're looking at. All automakers are now putting an emphasis on what they call lightweighting. And here's a simple reason why. The rule of thumb in the industry is that for every 100 pounds, that you take off the weight of a vehicle, you're going to save as much as a mile a gallon. So with the Ford F series, the F-150 in particular, losing as much as 700 pounds, we expect when they finally announce the formal EPA numbers that they could be down as much as 7 miles a gallon. Imagine a full-size pickup truck that might be getting, we don't know the hard numbers yet, but could be getting as much as 30 miles a gallon.
Speaking of EPA, there are upcoming fuel standards changing. They'll be stricter, I think, than current standards. Are automakers kind of looking out of the corner of the eye or in their rearview mirror? No, that's coming ahead. Are they watching those and keeping those in mind?
Yeah, they're definitely keeping that in mind, which is why you have things like displacement and demand. You have an F-Series pickup that's coming out of aluminum. And by the way, I didn't directly answer your question. The new F-Series uses an all-aluminum body. There's only one panel made out of steel, and that's because it's a panel designed to reduce noise. The chassis uses lighter weight steels, ultra high strength and high strength steels that can be stronger and yet lighter at the same time. You're even seeing carbon fiber, a technology that was once limited to only the most exotic cars like a Lamborghini, a McLaren, a Ferrari, or race cars like an F1. Well, that is now migrating slowly into the mainstream. It's still phenomenally expensive and difficult to produce in a mass volume. But you're seeing that, for example, on the new BMW i3 electric car. And many people believe that within a decade we could be seeing carbon fiber become a widespread material, something that a lot of manufacturers will need to meet. The reality is all these pieces, as well as hybrid technology, as well as pure battery electric, will be absolutely essential for the auto industry if they're going to meet the tough standards of 2016 and the incredibly tough standards, 54.5 miles a gallon, that the EPA has set for 2025.
How do you think the public's going to receive what we're seeing at the auto show today?
Well, if last year was any indication, it's going to be a very good year for the auto industry. Last year exceeded expectations going into 2013, ended the year with 15.5 million sales. The forecasts generally range between 16.1 and 16.5 million for 2014. And a lot of that is being driven not just by the economy starting to turn around, but by the fact that the industry is putting out some very exciting products. Now, where the boom, where things will grow this year is a big question mark. The surprise of 2013 was the comeback of that full-size pickup truck market. That grew from a right, a near record low of 1.1 million a year back in the depths of the recession to almost 2 million and could go even higher. And that's directly related to the recovery of the economy because a good percentage of people who buy pickups need it for work, contractors, fleet owners, and the like. So we're going to be watching very closely to see what segments of the market will take off again in 2014.
Paul, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Great to be with you.
That was Paul Eisenstein, publisher and editor of the DetroitBureau.com.
Up next, we'll learn about the centuries-old split between Sunni and Shia Muslims. But first, Noah Ovchinsky joins us now from the newsroom with a look at headlines.
The world news is full of stories of the divisions between the Sunni and Shia movements in Islam, right up to today in Iraq, with bombings linked to Sunni militants targeting mostly Shiite areas.
Our next guest will help us take a step back to understand the historical origins of this major split within the Muslim world. Carol Murphy is an independent journalist and author of A Kingdom's Future, Saudi Arabia Through the Eyes of Its 20-somethings. Carol, welcome to the show.
Hello, Judith. Nice to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. Carol, what first led to this split between the Sunni and Shia movements in the Islamic world?
Well, the sectarian divide really goes back to early Islam in the 7th century. After Prophet Muhammad died in 632, there were basically two factions among the early Muslims. One faction believed that the successor to Prophet Muhammad should be chosen from among his closest companions and advisors. But there was another faction that believed that his successor should come from his family, that the reign should be hereditary. And this faction was led by Ali, who was the cousin of Prophet Muhammad, and also his son-in-law. He had married the daughter of Prophet Muhammad. Her name was Fatima. So this competition lasted for some decades, and until there was, in 680, a really definitive battle between the Sunni and the Shia. And this took place in what's now southern Iraq. It was called the Battle of Karbala. And the Sunni armies there defeated the Shiites, and they killed the then leader of the Shiites, Hussein, who was the grandson of Prophet Muhammad. And since then, there's been this basic division in Islam. And throughout the Middle East, there are both Sunni and Shia communities. Sometimes they live in peace, and sometimes they don't. It's a split that's waxed and waned over the centuries.
So it doesn't sound like it's really a theological difference. It sounds like it's more of who should be leading the world's Muslims.
Well, you're absolutely right. This is a difference that's religious, but it's always blended with geopolitical and ethnic rivalries. For example, you know, the Arab world is Arab. They speak Arabic. They are predominantly Sunni, although there are two Arab states that have a Shia majority, and that's Iraq and the tiny island state of Bahrain. Now, Iran is sort of the leader of the Shia world, or wants to be. That's a predominantly Shia state, and they are Persians. They speak Farsi, so they're ethnically different from the Arabs. But as you know, in this part of the world, religion is always closely associated with government and politics. So behind the sectarian divide, there is always the political angle.
And would you say that both the Sunni and the Shia see this as an irreconcilable difference?
Unfortunately, I think today many do. Although, you know, the basic differences between them as far as the basic doctrine of Islam are not great. Both Shia and Sunni believe in the five pillars of Islam, which is good Muslim says prayers five times a day, he tithes on his income, he fasts during Ramadan, he makes the profession of faith, there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. And finally, if he or she can, they make a pilgrimage to Mecca. There's no big difference between Sunni and Shia on that. The differences come in how they interpret Islam's holy book, the Quran, and how they choose their leaders. The Sunni religious leaders have typically been associated very closely with the state. They've been state-appointed. the Shia religious leaders have basically risen through a process of consensus among their peers that this is a person whose scholarship is worthy of being followed. So unfortunately, today, in recent years, for several reasons, which I can tell you about, this sectarian divide has become much more intense in the last few decades. And this partly because, again, of the political differences that are driving it.
So there's been a lot of conflict over really centuries between the Sunni and the Shia. But have there been occasions in that history where they have actually been united against maybe a common enemy?
Well, sometimes they do, but I can't think of any case right now. But I can say that during, for many centuries, you know, there was the Ottomans ruling from the Ottoman Empire. They ruled most of the Arab world, and they had sort of a peace, a Pax Ottoman, where the Shia communities sort of led themselves and lived peacefully under that Sunni caliphate.
And let's look even more deeply within the Sunni and Shia sects of Islam. Have there been divisions or conflicts within each of those two larger groups?
Oh, definitely. There are different trends in Sunni Islam, and there are definitely different trends in Shia Islam. For example, the leaders of present-day Syria belong to a minority Shia denomination called the Alawites. And this is one reason that the leaders of Syria have had an alliance of almost 40 years with Iran, which is a major Shiite power. But in recent years, this sectarian rivalry has gotten more intense. And it began sort of with the Iranian Revolution in 1979, which brought to the fore a regime that's been very aggressive in pushing its brand of very conservative, almost fundamentalist Islam. And then Iran began to meddle in Arab affairs, especially in Lebanon, where it helped create this militia, political party called Hezbollah. And then came the invasion of Iraq. And that has had an impact on this sectarian rivalry. Why? For years, Iraq was ruled by its Sunni minority. But after the U.S. invaded and created a new regime there with elections, of course, the Shia majority, because of elections, was going to win. And now the Shia are leading Iraq. And this, because the Shia have had close ties with Iran, this has allowed Iran to have greater influence in the Arab country of Iraq. And this has made other countries, particularly Saudi Arabia, very nervous. Saudi Arabia sees Iran as its geopolitical rivalry in the Middle East.
And have you seen either a widening of the differences between the Sunni and the Shia, or perhaps a narrowing as a result of the Arab Spring that has gone across the Muslim world?
The Arab Spring, unfortunately, has led to a greater division, a deeper division. You can see the last couple of years has been increased conflict in Syria, in Iraq, in Bahrain, even in Lebanon, and many times, not always, because partly this is a political conflict, but sometimes it does have a lot to do with the sectarian Shia divide, especially in a place like Bahrain and Iraq.
And you've written about 20-somethings in Saudi Arabia. Is the Sunni-Shia divide something that's really forefront on their minds, or is it something that they don't think about as much as perhaps an older generation?
The answer is yes and no. I found that the younger people in Saudi are not as preoccupied with the prejudice against Shia. You know, the Shia make up only about 10 to 15% of Saudi Arabia's population, so they are a minority. The older generation is definitely much more anti-Shia. I'm talking about the Sunnis, among the Sunnis. The older generation is much more anti-Shia than the younger generation. But at the same time, I cannot say honestly that they don't have some prejudice still towards the Shia. It's just lesser, a little lesser than their older peers.
And just a follow-up on that before we're finished, do you think the younger generations will actually help to close the sectarian divide and perhaps bring some healing between the two sects?
I would hope so, but I don't see that in the foreseeable future, because one of the ways you reduce religious sectarian tensions is to have a more open, tolerant, democratic society. And right now, the Middle East is in such turmoil and such tumult that I don't see this coming for in the foreseeable future. I think it's going to possibly be another decade.
Carol, thanks so much for joining us today.
You're welcome, Judith. It's been a pleasure.
That was Carol Murphy, independent journalist and author of A Kingdom's Future, Saudi Arabia Through the Eyes of Its 20-somethings.